Good afternoon, good evening to everyone around the world. Just want to let you know I took off a couple of weeks and preparing for the new season. And while we're in the middle of summer, I've been knocking on doors and checking everybody out. First, I want to thank everyone for reaching out and starting to follow us on TikTok. I was against TikTok. And not because I'm an older fella. It's because when I hit the 1,000 mark or whatever it was, a couple thousand about a year ago, they decided somehow, some way, just to cancel my account. So I became, it was anti-TikTok. So once again, thank you, everyone. We've been pushing the True House Stories on TikTok, and everybody's been coming up and loving all the videos. And we're giving you flashbacks of some of the older shows. And of course, follow us on YouTube and True House Stories and all that good stuff. It has been a very wet summer, hot summer in New York. Also a very yucky summer so far. It's one of those summers you just want to go get it out. And you know what? All winter we wait to get to that point to wish when it's going to be hot again. And here we are. It's hot. And you're going, the sky is gray. It's dark. Whatever. So, welcome to True House Stories. This week, I am Lenny Fontana coming out of New York City. And we wanted to go back to England to a Mancunian, I said Manchurian, he's going to correct me, it's Mancunian area, Manchester, the area which I love in the north. Those who remember the Manchester movement, I'll give you a little story about that real quick. There was an album that came out, Sound of North, that was a big record called Voodoo Ray. And that record was being rocked hard on the underground scene with a guy called Gerald. Record came over to America with Tony Humphries when he brought it over and he started playing the record. And people started to really lock in to Manchester in that area because Hacienda was, you know, really doing its thing. Grand Park, Mike Pickering, and the whole movement. It just became a phenomenon. And a lot of guys, as we know, bridged off of that. And this gentleman right here I'm going to bring up is one of those fellas that has that history, having his labels, Looking Glass and Mad Hatter, working with Defected and many labels and doing this for decades. Not like he just stepped in. People may think he's brand new because they see brand new hot Defected record stuff coming out with his name on it and they don't do so much research. But those that know in the game know this fella has been around the block and a few times and back and around. And he's got stories. He's got real stories that it touch and they make sense. And a lot of times they're wise stories to how you can look back at different things of how things are today to what they were yesterday. So without further ado, I like to bring up Mr. DJ Nick Hussey.
Hey Lenny, how you doing, brother?
How are you?
Hello from Manchester. Mancunian, it's Mancunian.
I love it. You see, corrected Mancunian. The Mancunian. Yeah. See, I have Mancunian friends. I have Rowetta. I got Parky. I know a lot of people from that area that I love.
Yeah.
I love that area. It's such wonderful.
It's always been a huge house music city, Manchester. So, you know, from way back in the day, we got into it pretty early and we had the Hacienda and, you know, lots of other clubs. So it's always been on the radar, Manchester, for house music.
God bless you.
You've been here how many times? So many times yourself.
Oh, how many times did I play Hacienda? Besides playing Hacienda, I played Home. Yeah. I played all those clubs. But I always say the people are so beautiful in your area.
We like to party.
Beer and party. Beer and party.
Exactly.
One thing I can say that was really
interesting. Non-stop.
I will say that was very interesting that you had that was kind of on the dark side. So as great as you had the club scene, you also had like a mafia-run door policy going on with a lot of those clubs. And I remember those guys. Those were like some bone-crushing guys.
Yeah.
They were always calling me, hey, Lenny, how are you, man? But I seen them take some guys, and it was just like, man, they didn't play. Man.
It's serious. We were called Gunchester for quite a while. You know, we had the whole Manchester thing, but it was Gunchester because the gangs took over a lot of the doors of the clubs and, you know, ran all the rackets and stuff. So it was pretty hairy time at the time. But, you know, at the time, it was just such an exciting place to be. Then, that you know, you only saw that side of it if you were looking for it. You know, there were so many people coming having great nights that it just that got lost. But in the end, it did take over and, you know, closed Hacienda down, closed Home Nightclub down, closed a lot of nightclubs down. So it was a shame, but we're a victim of our own success, Manchester. You know, there's so much money to be made in clubs like that. You know, you're going to get stuff like that, unfortunately.
Well, you know, off camera, everyone, I was telling my man here, I said, I want to try something a little different. I wanted to bring out a first question, and then we'll get into like the background story of Nick's situation. I want to hit him with this one question. What, if you could put it into words, what would be the greatest highlight of your career?
It's got to be... every time I made a track, I had a club in mind where it'd be played. I was talking to Todd Terry about this a couple of weeks ago. He said the same. He always thought of a club when he was making a particular track it would suit. But mine was obviously, it was coming from Manchester, Hacienda. So I'd had played tunes played in other clubs, loads of times, but never Hacienda. And I was always waiting for Hacienda. And then one time, the lights came on, it was the end of the night, and I'm talking to a few people, and then they played one last tune, and it came on, it's some guy playing the piano and big gospel vocals, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm having a conversation with everybody, I'm thinking, yeah, I've got this record, what's this record? I'm thinking, yeah, I bought this record the last few weeks, and I'm trying to remember what it is, I'm like, oh my God, it's me! And it was, that was the moment that I'd always dreamt of, and it was happening, and I looked in front of me, and the whole place was going absolutely nuts. There's hands in the air, all the lights on. And it was just like, it was all I've ever imagined. You know, that's why I did it. And to see it come to reality was something, you don't really think you're going to achieve it. You always want it. But, you know, when it's there in front of you, it's just, you know, the hairs on the back of your hands, just, you know, every part of you is just elated. So I think that's got to be it.
Who was playing that record?
Parky Graham was playing.
Oh,
it.
The wonderful man himself, Grandpa, another alumni of True House. Great guy.
Yeah.
I'll say this about him. He's got excellent taste in music. He really knows his bits and bobs, you know?
He's a great guy, yeah. I used to watch him DJing, and I remember him, he had Slave to the Vibe, and he had two copies of it, and he was pulling one back and then playing it. This is the Hacienda. And nobody knew what he was doing, but I was watching him like, wow, you know, this was, you know, to see a house DJ cutting it back and scratching it like that, you know, it was just amazing. The whole place was going mad, but they didn't realize the work that was involved to make that moment happen. And I was just like, and he was just like, yeah, whatever, just cracking on with it. So yeah, he's really talented.
Yeah, Parky's got, you know, I give him a lot of credit.
Yeah.
But let's get into this a little bit about your life, you know, and I always ask the same to everyone, and I'm going to ask it to you, you know, how does music find you, or you find the music? Where does it begin for you? Take us on the journey, brother. Take us there.
Music was always around from, you know, being young. I come from a big Irish family, so every weekend was party time, and everyone picked up an instrument, you know, you just joined in, you know, banged the tin or, you know, whatever, just made some music. My dad, he played the accordion and bagpipes and stuff, and he passed when I was young, but everyone said, yeah, he just picked up an instrument and he could, you know, get a tune out of it. So I always had that on that side. And then one side, my uncle, he had like a huge record collection. So he collected Bob Dylan and Van Morrison and Rolling Stones, and then Tamla Motown, everything, Dionne Warwick and Marvin Gaye. And he had this record, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, and it had Mercy, Mercy Me on it. And every time I went, I must have been about 10 years old, every time I went to his house, just put this Mercy Mercy Me on and just listen to it and like again, again, again. So I always had that that music from a family, and alongside that as well, coming from Manchester, I mean, the music that was available to me in Manchester at a really early age, we had youth clubs. So there was lots of DJs and we were like, you know, 12, 13, and everyone was, you know, breakdancing, and there was DJs playing, you know, Eric B and Rakim and, you know, all that kind of tunes. One for the Treble, David DMX, you know, all these tunes, huge. So Arnie's Love, and another one I remember called Arnie's Love. So I got exposure to this unbelievable breadth of music at a really early age. And it was the youth clubs that really sort of ingrained it in me. So, you know, I had lots of other people listening to, you know, like Duran Duran and stuff like that, which I also listened to, but I was listening to a lot of R&B and soul music and absolutely loving it. Along with that, the radio stations in Manchester, there's a guy called Mike Shaft who used to do Sunday nights on Key 103, Piccadilly Radio. And I used to record his shows on a Sunday night, and I had a tape-to-tape recorder. So I used to get rid of the adverts and just have pure music for an hour, then go and sell them in school on Monday morning. So I was always doing my little hustle with music and getting involved in music from a pretty early age, really.
Of course, I'm going to say this to you. That sounds to me like an enthusiast that was on his way to find his DJ career. But I'm not going to say you started a DJing career at that age. You probably just more soaking everything in like a sponge, right?
No, I did. I started at 13.
Oh, just, the current young
just
age.
By accident. I was just at the youth club that I used to go to, and I just happened to be there was no plan. I just happened to be stood on the stage next to the decks when the DJ had a big argument with the manageress and walked off. And I was like, I've been OCD, seeing all these people in front of me and the record running out. And I'm thinking, what I'm going to do? So I picked up another record and put it on. I can remember the record as well. It was Barbara Fowler, Come and Get My Love In. Put the tune on and everyone's like, I got the nod off people. And I was like, yeah, I like this. And that was the start of my very brief DJing career at the moment. It's only a few weeks and the DJ came back in the end, but it was enough to get me hooked. And like, I was buying tunes anyway, so I knew which tunes to pull out, and I was pretty obsessed, but you know, that gave me that impetus to like, that's what I want to do in the future. Just by accident, complete accident.
So at 13, you started to get the taste of it. A lot of us back then, and when we were in those ages, we had here on this side of the pond, we had, you know, guys like, you saw their names on their records in those days, Shep Pettibone, T. Scott, you know, yeah. I mean, maybe you've never heard them to play, but a lot of them were on the radio in this area of the country, of New York radio. So if you weren't old enough to go out to night clubbing, you listened to the radio and like you did, record. Yeah. Sets and say, what we were trying to do is copy what they were doing. So were you doing that as well with listening to the guys to learn how to beat match, or somebody had to give you that first
It's funny you say Shep Pettibone actually, because he did, I think it was a Madonna mix and there was like a piano solo in the middle of it, and I just loved that piano solo, and I played it and played it and played it. It was like a Latin piano, and that was another thing that I thought, I've got to do this. So I just bought a keyboard and just tried and tried and tried. I didn't have any, you know, musical training or any formal training. I just wanted to make a sound like that. So Shep Pettibone was one of the reasons, I did it. I mean, I was always obsessed by producers, you know. I had Leon Silvers III, Mantronic, Arthur Baker, you know, all these people. I was more interested in producers from being a really young kid than the artists for a lot of people. And I always looked who produced it, and I always listened to tunes and analyzed the tunes and, you know, tried to break them down, which, you know, obviously helps a lot later on in life when doing my job now. But it was just something I was fascinated with. I didn't think there was going to be an end product. I didn't, you know, was it a great plan to be a record producer at the start? I just sort of accidentally fell into that, but everything that was leading up to me becoming a record producer was, you know, it was pretty obvious at the time.
Sure. No, I could see that. And also you had a big Northern movement, you know, a soul sound, which would be more categorized to a Motown sound, even preaching coming in. That was all around you. So it was inevitable for you to find that music because it was everywhere around you. From what everybody I always talk to talks about, the Northern soul.
Yeah. And Northern soul was huge.
Right. And it has, you know, at the Wiggum Casino, you always hear those same stories. And I guess those blocks, building blocks, so important to what came after. Because you guys basically carried the torch after that ended, in a sense. Yeah. Because didn't go on forever, you know?
Yeah. Manchester was, it was such a, for me personally, you know, soulful place. You know, one of the other big influences was there's a group called 52nd Street, and they were from my area. And one of my best friends, it was his brother, was the drummer, Mikey Wilson, and Diane Charmaine and Tony Bowers. They all lived, you know, around the block from me. So, and they had a number one Billboard track with Nick Martinelli as a producer. And I was only a young kid, but, you know, they were like 5 years older. And I just saw, like, you know, I can do this, you know. Somebody from around my way has succeeded and been really successful. You know, they made it more accessible, but it was the soul music at the time, you know, the Loose Ends and 52nd Street and stuff like that was just, that's what drove me at the time. You know, obviously house music wasn't around then, you know. It was just all about soul music, R&B and stuff like that, and then later on hip hop and house.
Glad you said that, because there was no house music in that time.
No.
It was what they called they called it R&B dance or R&B music. They didn't call it house. That was later.
Yeah.
A lot later.
Yeah. 86 onwards. But when it got to Manchester, it just exploded. It exploded like nowhere else, you know. You know, you had Adonis, No Way Back, and Lack of Love, and This Brutal House and stuff like that. And 86, 87, you heard it everywhere. You know, every car door that opened, you heard it. Every, you know, every street was playing it. You know, everything you could hear music was playing house music. And I went to other cities and they weren't getting it. So it was strange how it just exploded in Manchester. I'm not sure why it just exploded in Manchester, but it just seemed to.
Okay, so give us in your steps, your first meeting with Mr. House Music, because as everybody has that moment, a life change. I call it, it's like finding God. You know, it's like, because you never heard it before, right?
Yeah.
And you may have heard it, but not realize it's called that. But then you've seen it with thousands of people around you going absolutely mental. When is this,
I started my cousin Darren Leach. He used to DJ at a club in Chinatown in Manchester called the I Don't Know Club, and he called me up and he said, I'm going away for 2 weeks. Can you come for me DJing? And I hadn't DJed since I was a kid at this time, and I was like 18 or 19 or something. And I said, yeah, sure. He said, I'm just away for 2 weeks, and I went to the club. And he showed me mixing records as opening, just, you know, stopping and starting them. So he had like, I think it was like Joy Sims or something. And he was, you know, pushing it forward into the next tune. And I'm like, what the hell? And it was mixing two records together. So it was seamless. And I was like, whoa. And that just blew my mind at the time. So I worked for him, for his job for like 2 weeks. Then he never came back. He went to Greece and just didn't come back. So I, by default, got his job. So that was like £25 a night, which, you know, in the 80s was good money. And then this guy, I was aware of house music because we had T. Coy from Manchester, which is Mike Pickering, and Adonis. And but it wasn't a movement. It was just part of the tunes that you heard, you know, around the way all the time. It wasn't really classed as house music. It was still sort of classed as, I don't know, R&B or, you know, I don't, it was in that genre, just sort of dance music. And I had a guy call me up and he said, Nick Hussius, yeah. He said, do you play house music? So I said, why? He said, well, I want to start a house night, but I can only play like £75 a night. So that was three times more than I was getting playing where I was. So I just said, yeah, I'm a house DJ. And I went out and bought every house record ever made for like, you know, like 20 bucks and turned up and played all these house music records. And about 3 weeks later, it was just roadblock. It was just crazy. It was just word got around. It was a Thursday night at a place called Hamilton's in Manchester. And it was just insane. And it was just, wow, what is happening? You know, what is going on? Obviously, that was the very start of it. But, you know, then you had records like Can You Jam and Jason, Can You Dance and stuff like that, which just so euphoric, you know. We'd never heard anything like that before. You'd had disco and stuff, but that was sort of before our time. This was our disco. This was our euphoria where you just wanted to dance. You know, you didn't have any option but to dance and, you know, those chords and synths and stuff at the time. And it's just, as soon as I started playing it, I was like, right, yeah. I mean, I didn't call myself a house DJ. I was just a DJ. It wasn't, you know, certain genres. It's just... that's just what we played at the time.
Did you realize at the time that this was all coming out of the Chicago area?
We knew. Yeah.
You knew for sure, right?
We knew. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. We knew. Yeah. We were, you know, DJ International tracks and, you know, it was, you know, we had to have the hot new tracks record and it was, you know, because we used to get the records on, was it like a Thursday, I think? So they all come shrink wrapped in the record store and we'd all be waiting outside, you know, what we're going to get this week, you know, and you never knew what you're going to get. And, you know, it was just such an exciting time. You know, it was just like, I mean, obviously I was younger and it was like you prime your life, so you're exciting, but it was just nothing like everyone had ever seen before. You know, getting this shrink wrap vinyl. Yes.
Gotcha. Of course. So of course I know you know, it's like everyone at that time, this music is becoming the birth of something. And you as the artist is becoming something as well. I mean, you don't know yet where this is leading. Because you just, as they say, it's like you kind of like blindfolded in a way because you don't know what the next step is going to happen.
No. Well, I did my training and there was a place in Moss Side called The Kitchen. It was like a recording studio. So I was just listening to, it was like Kiss Radio or WBLS or something, local radio station, which just played R&B and stuff all day. And it came live from this recording studio in Moss Side called Kitchen. And I was just fascinated. And I really liked the sound of it. So I just gave them a call and said, you know, I heard you on the radio. Do you mind if I come down? They said, yeah, sure, come down. And I went down to the studio. I think this is about 1986. Yeah, 1987. Somewhere around that time. And I just walked through the doors. And I just looked around and I'm like, this is where I'm going to be for the rest of my life. I just knew at that moment that was me. I can't explain it, you know, unless you've had some epiphany like that. It's hard to explain to people, but I just looked around and I was just overwhelmed with this, like, wow, this is me. This is, you know, and I just spent every night. I used to go to work. I used to work in an office in the daytime. And try and save up money for my, you know, keyboards and records to play at weekend. And I just used to go there after work and tidy up and ask questions and sit there. And I just loved it. But at the time, it wasn't, house music wasn't out. It wasn't, you know, that's where a lot of people made the music. You know, you mentioned before Voodoo Ray. That's where they did Voodoo Ray and a few other tunes. But everyone was doing mainly sort of, you know, street soul, call it, you know, street soul at the time. And it just developed into house. There wasn't any like, right, we're going to do this. It's just more and more people started coming in playing, you know, house beats. And we had a 909, so that was the start of it, and an 808. And I had a TR-626 as well, and a DX-100. So we always used to, you know, pull our equipment and see what we could do. And it just developed into house. It was just more and more house.
So that epiphany moment, it's like walking into the church, and it's like when the gospel goes, and you feel that feeling, your hair stands up.
It's true. That's exactly what it was like. It was like,
right? It's telling people, it's like, I found Jesus. Oh my God. Where has this been my whole life? You know, it's like, it's literally like that. I tell people that all the time. You have no idea. Once you taste that drink.
Yeah. And there's no going back.
It's horrible because you always want it.
Yeah. Yeah. It always pulls you back in.
Yes. You want to leave it, but yet you get a little taste of that drink again. It's like, oh God, it's so damn good. You know, it's like the best drug in the world. No drug gives you that euphoric feeling, which you just described.
Yeah.
I've seen TV shows talk about this all the time. Yeah. They show a guy coming into like a club and he sees and they dramatize it. And I've tried to show this to people that never went to clubs and they don't get it. I said, until you really feel that feeling, you'll never know. It's like the moment you went down the roller coaster and that your heart drops, that energy, just the threshold, the G-force, same thing. Crazy. You described it perfectly. Perfectly. Yeah.
And that I've tried to sort of step out of music on occasions, you know, because it's frustrating. It's a hard life to lead sometimes because it's extremes. You're very successful 1 minute, then it's difficult the next, and you do want to leave it, but you just can't. You know, I sit down at the piano and just, you know, I sit a Fender Rhodes and just play it and
I'm glad you said that because that was going to lead me to my next question. I'm watching all the gear you mentioned about all the guys working at the studio at that time and you were getting a taste of this. Did you have any formal music training as a kid to work up to this?
No formal training. The reason I bought a keyboard was one of them because of Shep Pettibone track. And I used to be like a roadie from a friend's band called Look Twice. They were like a jazz funk band, you know, like sort of Weather Report kind of stuff. And they didn't have a keyboard player. So I'm like, I'm in. All I need to do is buy a keyboard and I'm in. You know, obviously a lot more difficult than that. But that's when I first bought a keyboard. And I used to sit there and just go over it and go over it. And I used to go to the pub with my friends, you know, on a Sunday, and I'd be sat there with my pint just tapping away and like, you're doing that thing again, Nick. And I'm like, oh yeah. And then I used to go to church with my folks and I'd be like, my mum would be like, stop, because I'd be playing the pew in front of me and she's like, stop doing it. And I could never stop. You know, I still don't do it. I'm always tapping things out. I hear things in my head. I'm always trying to play it in my head, and I'll play it without a keyboard there until in my head it's right. I know it's bizarre, but you know, that's the way I learned it. But I didn't have a clue about, you know, key signatures or, you know, what I couldn't do. And I think a lot of it at the start of it, that's what helped me make a lot of the early house tunes I made, because there were no rules. You know, I listen to a lot of the stuff now, and if you were formally taught, I don't think I would have made them, you know, because the chords are really bizarre chords and things theoretically clash, but, you know, they seem to work at the start of it. I don't know. You know,
there's a reason why, because it's a lot of that stuff's written in jazz minors.
Yeah.
And the vocals are out of key. So it's kind of like a coolness to the 90s sound. That was a big thing with it.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Notation wise and music theory, it's against all the rules and regulations of how you do records.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I did go to college after I had like one of my first records out. I thought, you know, I better, because I was moving into studio a lot more then, and I thought I better get a bit more musical knowledge behind me, you know, because I'm having a lot more
Why?
Well, it's just something that at the time I thought was necessary. You know, I don't know why. I just thought that was, you know, ever going to be taken seriously as a record producer, and I don't know even a keys A, B, or C. I felt a bit stupid. So I went to college, and everyone's coming in with the formal music and putting the music up there and playing this. And they said, so where's music? And I'm like, I don't have any. And they said, well, what can you play? And I said, oh, I'll just make something up. And they're like, what? And I just played a bit of freestyle jazz kind of stuff. And like, yeah, okay, you're in. So it was interesting because everyone had such constraints. And I think it taught me what not to do. So it was an experience going to college. I didn't last long, but okay. I'm glad I actually did try it in the first place.
So then let me bring in some perspective here. You know, I'm looking at, you know, you got an SSL desk, and I'm seeing the keyboard behind you, and I see an orange guitar amp sitting right behind you. I could sniff that bad boy ass, smell it.
Yeah.
It's burning with tubes. Who turned you into a studio? Because everybody gets that hand in where somebody says, come on, come hang out with us to look at the, you know, what you're doing and to get that bug.
Back to the studio. Now, is vocals. I mean, vocals has always been my thing, really. I've always really enjoyed vocals and doing working out harmonies and stuff. When I was a kid, I was always singing the top lines of songs and other parts, but I didn't know what I was doing at the time. But it was, you know, it was training for me. I did Sounds of Blackness and Jodeci and Shantae Moore and stuff. And I got all these stacked vocals. And for the Sounds of Blackness one, they sent me the original 48-track masters from Minneapolis. Like, I think Jamin Lewis did it. So they had the track sheets and the 48-track masters. So I got to isolate all the harmonies and stuff. And I sat there and listened to it. And I must have spent days and days in the studio, not actually doing a remix, but just listening to how the harmony's been put together. And then I work with a lot of gospel singers like Rachel McFarlane and Yvonne Shelton, and a guy really helped me, a guy called Barrington Stewart, a local Manchester legend. And I just always loved doing vocals. And that's what I love doing now. You know, I can do a lot of my work at home now. You know, I've got home studios, so you know, if you need to put a guitar in, I could just plug that in. I could do that, you know. Anything else, keyboard, can just plug that in. But vocals, you need a vocal booth, and you need, you know, you need a vibe, you know, singers have got to be in the right mood. I enjoy that process. I really enjoy getting the best out of singers. And I always have done. So that's the reason that I come back to studio now. That's what really floats my boat in the studio.
That's cool. That's super cool. I mean, you know, you've been blessed. Yeah. You know the difference between the golden era and today's era. Yeah. And you laugh about it. I say it, because let me say it one more time. Yeah. You know the difference between the golden era when there was no rules and rules were made to be broken then.
Yeah.
And now where there's all these rules, and everyone is like on the cookie cutter way of doing it.
Yep. It's like you've got so many options now. You know, you can get your door up and just get a vocal from anywhere. You can download it from Loop Cloud or something. It tells you what key it's in. It'll put it into the right tempo. It'll sort everything out for you. Back then, you know, when I first started doing it, we had an S950, so we had 9.5 seconds of sample time. So we had to get all the drums that we needed apart from the 909. So any drum loops or anything, we had to get all the vocals in those 9.5 seconds. So you have to become really creative, you know? So a lot of the stuff we did, we're chopping stuff up and making it work because we didn't have the option of doing anything else. So a lot of the creativity came out of that period when you're really limited and you know, you have to make things work. The other thing is studio time was so expensive. You had to make it work. You couldn't wait around. You couldn't sit there for days on end trying different bits and pieces because it cost money. You know, we were only young. We were only like 18, 19. You know, it was difficult to get studio time. So you had to get in there and make it work. Now, there's too many options, you know, there's too many vocals, there's too many things, and people still get it wrong. I can't understand. You know, people come in to me and they say, oh, we've made this, this banger,
no,
the track.
The problem is you don't have those good guys that you go knock on their door to play the tracks at those labels to say, what do you think?
Yeah.
That's what's missing. But wait a minute. This is what I want to ask you again. You said there's a program now that tells you what key and all that is. What program is that?
Loop Cloud.
Thank you. So you got Loop Cloud.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's already a big step in the right direction. An AI is already going to tell you how fast the tempo of the record is, what key it's written in, and even possibly take the record and rip it apart for you.
Yeah. Meaning you can, on Cubase now, you can just rip the stems. You can take all the stems apart. You take all the vocals apart and, you know, reprocess them, do whatever you want to it. With Loop Cloud, you can transpose the key. So say you're in, you know, A, and you want the vocal to be in A and the vocals in C, you just put in Loop Cloud the right key and it does it automatically. And it's like, and that's boring. A lot of music happens when you don't know what you're doing, and magic happens when, you know, things are accidental. And that's it's become more of a boring process now. There's not that excitement now. Maybe because I'm older and jaded, it might just be me, but you know, there's not the excitement that I used to get when I was younger because you've got too many options.
Let me clarify that. So basically that feeling of running to a studio, like when you were 21 or 23, you don't have that same burning feeling inside anymore. Is that it? Or I can wait and take care of something.
On occasions. Yeah. Because when I'm doing vocals, I love doing vocals. You know, I get a lot out of doing vocals. You know, I'll sing parts for the harmony for the singer, and I'll say, can you sing? And they say, that's not going to work. And I, oh, can you just humor me? Can you just sing that part? And can you sing that part? And they say, no, there's no way this is going to work, Nick. And I'm like, just humor me. And then I love putting it together and looking at the face as I play at them. And because I know it's going to work, I've already worked it out in my head, and I know it's going to sound great. And I love that feeling. It's still the same, you know, to see the singer's face and they say, oh, you've made me sound amazing. So I get the same satisfaction out of doing that. But there's not as much call for that work anymore for doing vocals because, you know, a lot of the people I work with, they come with a sample pack and they just want...
Oh, I hate that thing, the sample pack.
Yeah.
You know why, everybody? I hate the sample pack because you hear it in everybody's freaking records now, the same samples.
Yep. But this is the world we're living in. Like, it really hurts me as my job as a producer to make a track successful. I'll hear a great track and it's beautiful. And I hear myself saying these words and I hate it, but I've become that guy. There's too many words. And they're like, well, and they're like, yeah, there's too many words. I really like them, but if you want it to be a hit, you've got to like lose at least 60% of the words. And there's no art anymore. There's no art. I can make a great record, but I know it's not going to sell. I can make a record that I know is going to sell, but there's no artistic merit to it.
Do you still believe in the same old principle that a great song is a great song, or has that changed for you?
It has, because the great songs never get a look in anymore. It breaks my heart, you know, it really does, because I come from a songwriting background. You know, I wrote a lot of songs in the past and I'm really proud of them. And now it's just, I mean, you tell me what big songs are out there now, you know, there's hardly any. It's just hook, 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 hook.
Well, that's
the thing. They don't make sense, a lot of them now.
Well, you know what it was in like, back in the times of the 80s and the 90s into the early 2000s, the dub mixes were the big things at some of the clubs.
Yeah.
But everybody had their handbag anthem. that they would play.
Yeah.
You know, no matter who you were, if it was Finally or it was CC Penn, and I'm saying Sandy Rivera's Finally with Julie McKnight, or CC Penniston record, or Alice in Limerick with Love Lives. Like, that's like the, you know, the one that hits the heart.
Yeah.
But I understand that disheartening feeling that you're writing a great song. Like you said, I got to go in with a scissor and say, right, cut, 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 cut. Oh, we keep that little section goes, da, 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 da. Put it, copy, paste, copy, paste.
Copy, paste, copy, paste.
And it's done.
This is it. I actually got asked to do CC Penniston Finally at the time because I was working a lot with A&M Records, and I said no. And they said, "What do you mean? This will be really good for your career." And like, there's some records, just leave it. You know, Finally was one of my favorite tunes back then, and I thought, if I can't add something to it, if I can't improve it in any way, what's the point of me doing it? You know, I'm going to listen to that track and make it worse. I don't want to do that.
That's a
but lot. A lot of people will just take the money and do anything.
Right, and just do it. I mean, there's very few guys I could say that take a record and improve on it where the remix.
Yep.
Just a handful of guys can do that. Not many. Yep. I've heard more bad than actually good, if not great.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly.
Speaking of which, I want to remind myself or just refresh my memory. Was the Hussy mixes part of DMC in the beginning?
Yes.
Oh yeah, my God. My mind's going. When you said, I'm thinking, when you said A&M, I'm thinking, was it the tenure of Wolfie or was it under
Wolfie?
Steve
Wolf? My man Wolfie. Yeah.
Mr. Wolf. The Wolfie. Wolf is living strong. He's stronger than
Wolfie. Better. Wolfie, you know, I've got a lot to thank Wolfie. I still speak to Wolfie quite often, and I've got, you know, almost everything in my career for Wolfie because he helped me so much. When I got my first Sounds of Blackness track to do, it was through him because he'd left A&M Records and gone to MCA. So I get a phone call in my little tiny apartment in Manchester at the time. And I was doing bits and little bits and pieces, and I got a call, and the guy on the phone said, "Hi, is that Nick Hussey?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "It's Richard Marshall from A&M Records." I was like, "Yeah, okay." He said, "I've been giving your name. We want you to remix Sounds of Blackness." I was like, "Get out of town. Who's this?" I thought it was a joke. I mean, because Sounds of Blackness was like, you know, the biggest thing you could do. And I was thinking, little old me, do Sounds of Blackness. There's no way. And he said, Steve Wolf has given me your details. He's just left. And I was like, oh, right, yeah. He said, "Tell you what, Nick, do you have an A&M record there? I said, "Yeah." He said, "Look at the phone number on the back and give me a call back." So I said, okay. Still not really believing it was, you know, I thought it was someone on the wind-up. So I got the number on the back, called up A&M Records, and I said, "Can you speak to Richard Marshall, please?" He said, "Who is it, Nick Hussey?" "Oh, yeah, he's expecting your call." Like, "Hi, Richard." And he said, "Yeah, Wolfie said you're the man to do the Sounds of Blackness. So can you do it?" So I was like, "Yeah." And that was number one in the dance charts, my mix, for like, I don't know, about 3-4 weeks all over Europe. So that's the one that...
I remember back at that time. Cheers. I remember I was very close to Wolfie. I remember getting copies of that back then and saying, "Hussey's on." I said, "That was a good move." I remember telling the Wolf.
Cheers. That's him. Ooh. What a guy. What a guy, you know.
Oh, he's a dog. I love him. Known forever. Yeah. I mean, he's a great, he's a great businessman. I mean,
yeah, fantastic. He's
stronger than ever. So, because I was, you know, it's funny when you say about the era of the time, and I remember seeing the DMC mixes coming out with your mixes, a lot of stuff at that time.
That's right, yeah. I did Federal Hill and Joy Cardwell and I did a lot. I can't remember. But I also did the Loved Up mixes as well. So I did under the Loved Up name. So that was quite a few. Because I just got to pick my favorite records. Daphne Change, I did a few others. Yeah, so that was good because, you know, you just got to pick your favorite records at the time, and there you go, there's the vocals, do what you want with them. So yeah, it's good times. I used to go to down to DMC in Slough and stay over for a few days and have party time with Dave Seaman and everyone in the office.
Yeah, I was gonna say, that's got to be Tony Prince in the office at that
Tony
time.
Tony Prince, yeah, and
his
and,
son Dan, Danny, Dan Prince.
Danny, yeah, Danny, and what's his mum called?
Linda, I think.
Tony's wife.
Is it Linda?
No, Jacqueline, is it?
Jacqueline. Yeah, because when I brought Tony on the show, Tony forgot that he was supposed to be on the show that night. And he says, I'm having wine with my wife.
Yeah.
And she's saying to me, don't you have something to do tonight? He's like, oh my God, he jumps on. I got to go do the show. And we're all sitting there waiting for Tony Prince. So I have to give Tony Prince, he's a character. And I remember him running that office. Must have been always a party time in there with him back in the day. Yeah, so you've been around some good stock, my man. You've been around some good, strong pedigree people, like heavy, powerful people. It's not, you know, not many could say that, you know, and still to be here to talk about it now. What happened? Wait, I'm sorry, Nick. Hold on. I'm sorry. Somehow you got. Oh, your mic's not connected. Something happened. Or you have to unmute the mic on your end. Oh. There you go.
Okay. Yeah.
So, as I was saying, not many could talk about, you know, being in the battle.
Yes.
And still come out, enjoying it and loving it, you know?
You've got to adapt, you know. The thing I always liked about music as well is I like doing things a different way. I never felt settled. I always wanted to do something different and, you know, different keyboards, you know, different drum machines, different effects, you know. That's the thing that always drove me. If you can keep doing that and different genres and, you know, different inputs, that's why I really enjoy working with people, because I get a different point of view. You know, the way they look at things is different from mine. That's why I always learn from whoever I sit next to in the studio. I always learn just because it's different, you know. So I've got a very, you know, forward-thinking way of doing things. I think I get bored very easily. I've got I think what you call ADHD now, so I'm on the move 100 miles an hour all the time, and I always like listening to new tracks, you know, new sounds. That's what influences me. So I think you've got to have that mindset, because a lot of people I know give up, or you're just getting stuck in a rut doing the same songs, the same kind of music, for, you know, which we've all moved on. I mean, it's coming full circle now, but some people don't learn from stuff. I think you've always got to learn from stuff and move the times.
Well, that's going to
be excited by it.
That's going to keep you as a trendsetter.
Yeah.
Back then, your heroes of back then are different now, because you're kind of a hero to some of the younger guys. So you're not looking. It's kind of hard when you're at the other side of it, you know what I'm saying, of the looking glass. It's not like you were looking in. Now you're inside looking out. It's a different it's a different animal altogether.
It is.
So back then, when you were in your golden time, let's just say you'd have your Frankie Knuckles and your Parkies and F People crew and all that would be. You would want, like you said, T-Core. You were aspiring to go. These are people that were in the hood, right in your backyard. Now looking at it from today, what are you looking forward towards that keeps you going? And that answer, everyone tells me a lot. They just left me like, oh, my God.
Wow.
Wait, you
could have been giving me a better notice for that question.
Wait, I got nothing to hang on to anymore. I'm leaving you. All right, let me rephrase the question one more time. You said it correctly before. You said, you know what, the way principles of doing things now are a little bit different. They borrow some of the older techniques and is a full circle.
Yeah.
Are you still holding on to the old stuff in your mind and that's what keeps you going to implement new? Or are you looking towards some of the younger and newer guys to kind of give you the inspiration?
I've come full circle. But a lot of the guys having the studio now, and girls as well, I've done a few tunes lately, which is just a 909, an M1 piano, and you know, an organ bass line. And they're like, wow, that's genius. How do you think of that? And well, we've been doing it like 30 years. So it's all the same sounds, and all those same sounds, and those same keyboards and drum machines. They all want the same processing. It's weird. They all want that sound, but they don't realize it's, you know, all been done before. So they all think you're a genius, but it's just, no, just the same old stuff 30 years ago. But I find it amusing. But I mean, it's not, music's music. It's not up to us to decide who's right or who's wrong. You know, music now for them, that's exciting. And, you know, what it was for us back then, you know, music's, we have our part of it, and then music moves on. You know, I never like to, you know, look down on people because they do things differently. It is different, you know, and our time was different, and I'm glad we did have our time then. But, you know, music's still exciting. It's never not going to be, you know.
But when you said the thing that I wanted to bring up, you said the certain sounds, the certain things that we know where they come from.
Yeah.
And I'll say this from my own experience. Back in the day, people, first of all, when you start to make house music and you went into a store, brand new store of a place where it sold keyboards and equipment, and you said to them, hey, I want to buy a Roland. Oh, no. What's this sound on this record? Like you'll play if you don't know anything. And if you have somebody knows what they're doing, they'll say, oh, that sounds like a 909 drum machine. Yeah. Here's the thing. At that time, when you went to ask the question, okay, how do I get a 909 drum machine?
Yeah.
They didn't make them anymore. They were already stopped making that stuff.
Yeah.
So half the battle of making a record, if you wanted to say copy Kenny Dope, or you wanted to be part like Tartary, or do stuff like I was doing, or Victor Simonello, any one of us, like yourself, you had to kind of work out what we were using to make those sounds. Now, it's like add water and stir. All those sounds are available.
Yeah.
Like you said, it's perfect. But here's the thing that I want to ask you. How do you know, or somebody knows, to make it sound like something we've done? See what I'm saying? That's the trick.
How do they know?
Yeah, how would they know to do that? Because back in the day, what we do is we take the records around, ask people questions, and they kind of clue us up.
I get a lot of emails now, people asking me what keyboard or what preset I used on certain records that I made. So, and it's usually the most obvious one, you know, like organ 2 off the M1 or an M1 piano and stuff like that, because I did a lot of, you know, early house on that. Back in the day, we were more limited, you know, so there was only certain amounts of keyboards. So I knew all my keyboards inside out. I knew every preset. I knew every single one. And, you know, like I had a DX100, and there was that solid bass, which was used off loads. And, you know, obviously, like I said, the M1. And a Juno for strings, Juno 106. It just stood out, you know. As soon as you heard them, you knew, oh, yeah, that's... Or maybe that was just me, I don't know, but I just knew what keyboard was what. Every keyboard had a certain quality to it, a certain sound to it back then. Now there's so many, it's really difficult to tell because, you know, a lot of them sound the same. But back then in the 80s when we started doing it, you know, you had Fender Rhodes had a certain sound, you know, you had your M1 piano, then you had an Ensoniq piano, which had a lot of chorus on it, which a lot of people used. And then obviously the 909 and 808. So you didn't really have to learn a lot, you know, to know what every sound was. Now, forget it. But you're still using the same sounds we did then. So
isn't that crazy?
Just doing something right.
Isn't that crazy? Because I've said this to everyone. Up until recently, until these sounds were not available.
Yeah.
you didn't hear any of these sounds anywhere. Now, all of a sudden, you're watching a lot of these companies coming out with these plugins, Arturia, yeah. Many of them are coming out, and these yeah. boards, these, like, I had, you know, a real mini Moog here, yeah. and we tested AB. It's very difficult to tell the difference now.
Can't tell, yeah, yeah. The Arturia ones are great, fantastic. The copies are unbelievable.
Even the Roland library. The Roland library sounds amazing now.
The Roland library are amazing, but they take too much CPU, so, you know, it's... They're really intensive, CPU heavy. So I just switched to the Arturia one, and they're very pretty light. True. But if you go back into the back to the day, so like I'm in the studio now. It's a really hot day. A day in the studio back then, everything would go out of tune. Yeah, I used to have Juno would go out of tune. I used to have an SH-101. Forget it. It'd stay in tune for like 3 minutes, and then it was out. So you're constantly trying to tune stuff. You know, you don't have a clue how easy it is now, you know, compared to back then, you know. And then you had, you know, hum off, you know, cables, you know, then you had to find the right MIDI chain so everything would work in time. You had to do the drums first and then the bass. And then, you know, because it was on a chain and things would go out in sequence. And, you know, it was so complicated then. And now you just switch your laptop on, put a tuner on, all good.
So in the sense of remixing, Mr. Hussey, back then you would get these R&B acapellas like a Sounds of Blackness that's slower. Yeah. And you'd have to kind of do your time stretching, or we want to make it tempo that works in a house yeah. record.
Yeah.
What was that like for you then comparing to now, you know?
Well, I did pretty well because I did a track called London Jones, yeah. And it was... The tempo was pretty slow, so the tempo was, say, 75 BPM. You know, it was an R&B track. So everybody else had naturally tried to speed it up. So, you know, you go from 75 BPM to 120. That's a big jump. And when you're doing it, and we're doing it on S1000 samplers, so it just sounded like chipmunks, and it was really, really difficult to do that. So with London Jones, I thought about it a bit differently. So I slowed the vocal down. So took it from like 75 BPM to 65 BPM. And I just changed the beats underneath it. So the vocal sounded nearly the same, but there's a house beat underneath it. And everyone's like, have you done it? No one could figure out how I'd done it, but I just changed the beats. That's the way I'd done it. So I got loads more work because everyone, I was the go-to man for R&B into house.
So. See what I'm saying? Like you found your calling, like out of nowhere, yeah. because you slowed yeah. it down and then you double timed it, which yeah. was one of the old tricks we used to do back in the day.
Yeah.
Now yeah. you could do create with all this technology and all this, what the AIs are doing. That's what I was going to ask you with the AI world now.
Yeah.
Have you been checking out where they're morphing, yeah. say, anyone's vocal from Justin Bieber to Frank Sinatra to AC/DC? You think that's okay for us to be doing this? What do you think?
No, not at all. You know, it's a strange world we're heading into. You know, where's it going to stop? I sound like an old timer now, but you know. What are you going to do with it? I do use AI, you know, I use AI a lot in my mixes now. I use Isotope. So, you know, they clean things up a bunch and make work a lot easier for me. But, you know, we're changing the vocals and stuff. I mean, who owns the copyright to that?
No, that's the thing. So now all of a sudden you can now actually type in, because Paul McCartney just did it. With one of those Lost Beatles records, he needed John yeah. Lennon's voice to complete it.
Yeah.
And Paul's like, look, you know, it's John, I wrote the song, it's yeah. John Lennon's voice morphing, yeah. and we're able to complete this thing. And he thinks it's okay. I mean, it's just the way the world is going now. It's not going to be.
The thing is, we've just got to get used to it, because they're not going to stop it now. It's out there, you know. You can't put these things back in the box once they're out there. How do you think it's going to go? What do you think?
I already know what I'm going to be doing. So, here's my plan, everybody. I'm going to build the new Lolita Holloway for today. You know? That's the one voice I think we're missing in the game, everybody. Come on now. Send...
Okay. Hello?
We were having this conversation with a bunch of producers, my really close friend, and he's like, I'm going to figure out how to write this program. And I'm like, I just feel bad because, again, here we go. One last
thing. You know it's going to happen.
You're taking the food away from these people.
Yeah.
Drake is already sued. Bieber's sued. What scared the hell out of me was when I saw David Guetta write this thing and say, check this out. I got Justin Bieber singing, but Justin Bieber didn't sing it. And we're morphing, and I'm like, this is not good. It's great, but at the same time, it's like watching the movie Terminator. You know it's coming.
It's just what we did, though, back in the day. You know, people can look at it the same as us sampling Louis Holiday and Justin Brown back in the day and putting them on our records. It's the same thing. It's just a different evolution of it. Well, we got sued, so yeah.
Yeah, I had to pay shitloads of money for that stuff to use their voice to use their music and their voices. And you know how that works is once here's the problem with that. So you do it as something where you say, okay, I'm gonna do something really cool for the club scene, and then this thing blows up. Now you're in a position like, oh my god, we got a chance for a hit record. Now what? Oh, we gotta go clear this thing. How much they want? 100,000 pounds? Yeah. Oh my god. And all the publishing.
We did a track, Rhythm of Life, called Touch Me back in like 1990, and we sampled Alicia Warren, a track by Alicia Warren. And at the time it was like we didn't know the rules on sampling because it had never been done before. And some people saying, oh, you can get sent to prison for it, and you know, it was a bit of a grey area because it was all brand new. And I knew that the guy that wrote it was a guy called Rob Manley. He was at Virgin Records, 10 Records. He actually wrote the track. And I went into a record store where I used to buy my records, a guy called Ken Grogan. And he said, I'd already made this record and it was ready to go. And it was on like test pressing. And Kenny said, oh, I've got a guy who wants to meet you. So I said, who? And he turned around and said, Rob Manley. And I was like, And he put his hand out. He said, I love what you've done with my track. I absolutely love it. I want to sign it to Virgin. We think it's going to be a big hit. So we're like, oh, wow. Well, yeah, that worked out really well. So we were getting all the contracts sorted. And it got back to Alicia Warren. And she said, no, it reminds me of a bad time in my life. I don't want you to use it. So we had to not put a record out, stop the record. In the meantime, about 15 other people sampled it and put it out for free anyway. So it was just one of those things.
That's a disheartening thing because that's where you say, damn it, could have had a massive hit. It's happened to all of us.
Yeah. But it's still happening now. I had a record out like about 5-6 weeks ago called Wanna Be with me and Jamie Van Gulden and Alexis. Singing on it, Alexis Hall, and she played me one down the phone like 2 days ago. Somebody's already sampled it and made a tune out of it and released it. give us at least our time span of 6 weeks of having a track with it out before you sample our record, not credit us and put it out as your own. It's like, wow.
did you do a takedown, copy, digital takedown, or no?
Yeah, it's all going ahead, but you know. Just blows my mind that somebody would take it without even, you know, mentioning it. You know, I would have given permission. I've done it in the past. You know, I love people's creative takes on my work.
Now, wait a minute. Now that you say that, I need to stop you. This is what the problem is with the whole industry.
Yeah.
People don't understand the rules and the regulations of how things work. Yeah. That's the problem.
Yeah.
You send a contract to somebody, they don't even look at it, they sign it.
Yeah.
It's a different world now. So what are you dealing with here? It's like, what do you do now? You tell them, make sure you look. Oh no, I don't need to look at it. Just they just sign it. Here you go.
But a lot of the guys have in the studio, they get contracts, and they've signed it. And I said, do you want me to let me look at it? I've had a lot of contracts. No, it's okay. We signed it already. So did you read it? No, because everyone's so used to pressing on their iPhone. Yeah, okay. Nobody ever reads anything now, and no one's aware of any of the rights anymore. So, God knows what's going to happen in the future. These guys did have a big hit. It's happened to all of us. We've all had hits, and then the money's just disappeared. And, you signed this. Don't you remember?
Nope. I don't remember nothing. That's the difference there. Can you give some people advice about that? Like, what do you think it should be done there? How do you think people should handle their business? How do you handle your business, in a sense?
Well, I mean, back in the day, we all had, the music industry was a lot different place. There was a lot of money and then lawyers were involved. So, you always got your contract looked over. Now, who's going to look after your contract for you? You need someone with experience. I always try and all the people I'm in the studio, I'll always look after them, and go through the contract and say, scrub that, and help them as much as you can. But it's difficult if you've not got access to somebody like us that can advise you to say no. What are you going to do?
Where do you go? Until later on, the record's played on Coca-Cola commercials and Bentley, and then your favorite championship Manchester team is playing your record as their anthem, and you're going, oh my God, I'm not seeing anything.
No, that's happened, so many times.
Oh, that's the story of decades. You hear that same story.
I think it's a rite of passage in the music industry being ripped off.
Oh, yeah.
At the start, it happened so much for me. But I just wanted to get in the studio. I just wanted to make another track. I didn't care about that. I just wanted to make music. I wasn't into it for the money or the greatness. I just love making music. And I think I was probably aware I was going to get ripped off again on this one, but I don't care. I didn't care. I just wanted to get in that studio and make another track. That's my legacy. All the tracks I've made, not, huge empire behind it. It's the music. That's all. It's all ever been about me.
So it's basically it's a passion thing in the beginning. Yeah, and absolutely. That never left you. I can hear it. That heartful, passionate feeling of the virtue of I need to make a record to make the record, not caring about success, money, power. You just wanted to make great, or you felt great.
That's music, it, right? For me and for my friends, that's all I cared about. And then playing it in a club after you've made it, making it that day and then taking it straight and playing it off a DAT machine in the club and seeing everyone go crazy. You just can't beat that feeling. There's just nothing like it. It's like scoring a goal at, at Old Trafford or, that's something right. like that.
You hear that sound?
Yeah.
That sound.
Yeah.
Makes your telephone up that, right?
Yeah. And what's coming. The next bit. They're going to go sick, they're gonna go crazy for this next bit, and you're like, yeah, wait, and then you see it and they'll go mad and you're like, yeah, that's me done. Yeah.
Score. That's what you're feeling. You're not saying a word, you're being quiet, you're watching, you're taking it all in, but inside that little guy is screaming, We did it, right? Over and over.
Yeah.
Oh, how about this one? Because everybody, he talks about all the good. He talks about all the good. What about when we do so much good and we fail? And it just doesn't happen. And he knows what I'm talking about. It's happened to everyone. I don't care how big, great Quincy Jones or you are, or Chick Corea, or, we all know the same thing that happens. What's that like? You put all the energy and power into something. You put all your money, time, efforts, love, blood, sweat, and tears, and it doesn't promise. What do you do?
It's sometimes just the ones that you put the most love behind, when they fail, it's, you know, it's hard. It's part of you. It's you know, it's part of your being. So, and a lot of the times, one of the ones that I didn't think would be successful have been successful. And then some of the ones that I think 100% sure that's nailed on hit, doesn't even get signed. And you're like, all these years of experience, you know, what do I know at the end of the day? Music's subjective, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a subjective thing. You just don't know. You just got to try. I guess with every, you know, they'd say you can have 1,000 failures, but those 1,000 failures or mistakes you made is what makes that one success.
Yeah.
You know, it's important that you have to have, in order to be good at something, you have to, I guess you kind of have to fall down and fail a bit. As much as they're not really failures, they're more like...
Because you learn from failure. It's the only way you learn. Yeah. You just got to kick, you know, get back up and do it again.
So from now to the eternity, where are we taking ourselves, Mr. Hussey? Where are you taking this road show? What are you thinking about?
Just keep on, you know, keeping on. I like helping a lot of young artists coming through. I really enjoy that. I really, you know, seen it. I've got a girl, Lily Myers. She's 14, and she loves coming in the studio, and she's making some great tracks. And you know, to see the passion in that generation that I had at that age is great. That really drives me. You know, that I'm really lucky. You're the same in your job. We travel a lot, and we've got a lot of different friends from all over the world. You know, that really drives me. You know. We're blessed. We really are truly blessed to be able to do this job. And I'm just going to, you know, hold on to it for as long as I can, as long as I can stay relevant.
The key is to be healthy and sane. If you can stay sane and be healthy, you can keep going.
I'm healthy. Right? I don't know about sane.
Well, you know, everyone, you're going to have to follow him on Spotify because that's where life is now in his world. Yeah. Not like I'm going to tell you go buy his 12 inches. It's, you know, he walks with a big stick still, and he cracks that stick hard, and those records are keeping on going because he's still working with some of the best record labels in the game. So he's got to be doing something at least a minimum 50%, right? You know, because I don't even want to say 100% because I don't know. I don't know what 100% is anymore.
None of us do.
You know, and this is not an insult. This is not an insult. It's just, like you said, the ones you don't put any time behind sometimes go out and become standout records. And ones you put all your heart, you go, how did we miss that one? What happened?
Yeah. Like I did two tracks back in the day. We were doing I'm a Dreamer and Rhythm of the Night. And I never thought anybody would listen to them. And now every time you put the radio on, you hear these tunes. And, you know, I just thought, after they were successful, I thought, I'm giving up. I don't know anything about music because these are the last tunes. I thought, you know, I took the work because, you know, you take the work. But I never thought they'd be so successful. And 30 years later, you still hear them on the radio all the time. And, you know, not the most... The best tracks I've ever worked on.
Well, that I'm a Dreamer has that organ sound in it.
Organ sound, yeah.
That everybody, you know, at that time, you had a few records that were making their bones. Crystal Waters was one of them.
That's right, yeah. Well, I was speaking do you know Sten, Stonebridge?
Yeah, I was going to say it's going to be Stoney. Stonebridge, his sound.
I was talking to him about this. About the whole organ sound for Robin S, and he said it was complete accident, Nick. So I said, what do you mean? He said, I played a bass line in and I was just scrolling through sounds and I just went on to organ 2 on the M1 and I was like, wow. And he said, that was it. There wasn't any, you know, big plan behind it. It was set on the channel and it was the only effects we'd had on it. It sounded awesome, so we kept it. So, you know, this is how these things happen sometimes.
So here's the deal, everyone. We found fire and burned the place down. Oh, wait, don't touch it. It's perfect. You go.
Yeah, just leave it. Leave it be. Yeah.
The trusty Hammond B3 that Korg sampled and made in the I know the patch. We all know that patch. I think it was called Perk Organ, if I remember correctly, something like that. Perk Organ, one of those. Well, it was definitely. Yeah. And as soon as you play that bass line, you go, oh, wait a minute, that's Robert S.
Yeah, it just works. Just works.
I'm done. I have no more questions. Mr. Hussey has taken us on a joyride to Manchester, awesome. UK. Okay, so I'm going to leave this last question for you. Mm-hmm. Since you're an aspiring new record producer in the new time, are you ever going to stop DJing and traveling? Oh, I know. It's a thought. It's a head thing for a second. I know.
I love it too much. All the parts of my job, the studio production side, the traveling side, and the DJing side, all fit into my life perfectly. I couldn't do one without the other. You know, if I'm in the studio too long, I go a bit stir crazy, and I don't come out with the right music. I need to go out and DJ, and I need to travel. And the same if I'm DJing all the time, I get too tired. I need to go back home and get the ideas out of my head. So if I stop one, I have to stop all of them. So, and I don't see how I could stop doing it at the moment. As long as I'm still being booked and still being paid, then that's, you know, I'm going to keep on doing it. As long as, you know, God bless my health keeps up, you know, that's the one thing that we all have to worry about. But
can you still keep up with the best? Are you still going and caning it? Or you said, I can't cane it. I just got to come and do the work and get on the planes, because that's where you feel a slowdown. You can't, you know, it's hard to cane all night, city to city to city, and then like be like 25 years old, jump up and go, I'm ready. You know, it's just, you feel it, you know?
It's like, back in Miami, I'm just going to bed now, and I'm getting up and seeing these guys come back, and I'm like, oh, I'm glad that's over.
Exactly, because back in the day, that's how we look when we were coming back, like dragging our tails back in.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And they were looking at us like, "Are you all right?" We're like,
"Yeah,
yeah, we're all right. I'm all right. Yeah, I'm all right. No, you're not." What an amazing interview! Oh, this was so great. You're wonderful. Great.
Really enjoyed it.
You're a legend in your own time, mate.
You too, Lenny.
And you got to keep doing what you do. Just keep pounding those records out, because, you know, we need quality. Quality always overcomes what I call mediocrity.
Yeah, and keep guiding the next generation.
And thankfully, True House Stories, we're at all these wonderful people. We're just about 3 years now.
Fantastic.
And we're going to be doing some special shows coming up, and we got some great people coming on, and like yourself. And I'm just so glad I reached out and heard your story, because to hear it like that, you don't get a chance to really get it like this. So good on you, my friend, and we wish you all luck. And everyone around the world, I want to wish you all a good night, and we will be making announcements to some of our new guests coming on. We're going to take a momentary break for another week or two, and then we're going to start heavy again. And thank you all for tuning in. Keep following us on TikTok, True House Stories on Instagram, and of course, www.truehousestories.com to stay with some of the past shows. And we remember, everyone, we've had some amazing heavy hitters. And this show is one of those that are unprecedented, to have the kind of great, great talent that we've all been blessed to hear, just like Mr. Nick Hussey. Again, Amina Zen, Guten Nacht, and thank you all. Good night.
Good night. Take care.